the week of September 30th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 165, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, it's time once again to bring all of our listeners the top entertainment news of the week, the top entertainment headlines. And, of course, we do this every week. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or any podcast or RSS aggregator. But you can also, of course...
There's nothing sexier than the phrase podcast aggregator.
That's right. That is a very sexy phrase. What about, like, email feedback? You can email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T @showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is toll-free. It's 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. So I'm changing it up a little bit, Michael. I'm putting some of this information, this feedback information, at the beginning of the show so that our listeners who don't make it to the end of the show know it.
Well, what will they be giving feedback on? What stories are we covering this week?
Well, I predict that on this week's show, we will totally geek out as we discuss a new music service from, of all people, rocker Neil Young. Young has been complaining and, you know, very loudly about the inferior sound qualities of MP3s.
And CDs.
And CDs for quite some time. And, you know, rather than just bitch and moan about it, as many, many have, he's actually come up with Pono, which promises to deliver studio quality sound, or as it's being dubbed, SQS. Now, I wonder if MySpace will offer SQS. Remember MySpace, Michael?
Barely,
yeah. We kind of have a MySpace page, but we've never touched it here at Showbiz Sandbox.
We do?
Yes. There, see, we have it.
Because we have so much music. We sing and perform so many songs.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, the website was once king of the social networks and has since fallen on harder times, though its new owners are teasing a snazzy new relaunch, which looks as if it transforms MySpace into some kind of music portal. We'll have to fill you in. And I wonder if MySpace will have to pay royalties for the music that is streamed from its new website. Pandora certainly does, and they are hoping that new legislation moving through Congress will lower their royalty rates. Some financial analysts, however, say that Pandora's royalty rates should actually rise, which seems shocking. We'll explain why that is. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world this weekend is Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis in Looper, the time travel sci-fi action film. It made $57 million worldwide. It was number two in North America, but it had a big opening overseas. At number two around the world is Hotel Transylvania, the animated film. It grossed $51 million worldwide. Most of that came in North America, where it made $43 million. It set a new record for September for an opening weekend. And I haven't seen the film, and Sperling hasn't seen the film, but I'm willing to lay down money that during the closing credits or some point during the film, they sing Hotel Transylvania to the tune of Hotel California. I think it's inevitable. I don't know how they could avoid it.
I don't know where, I didn't know where you were going there. I was like,
living
what
it
is
up
he talking?
At the Hotel Transylvania. I mean, they're just going to, the monsters will be dancing. That's what they'll do. At number three around the world is Resident Evil Retribution, another $23 million worldwide. It's at $176 million and counting. At number four, we have a three-way tie at $9 million. Ted, the comedy by Seth MacFarlane, more on him later. Ice Age Continental Drift, another $9 million. And The Dream Team, which is a French comedy about professional soccer players who somehow band together to help some people. I'm not quite sure what it's about. But, you know, Ted, of course, is at $434 million worldwide. Ice Age is now at $853 million worldwide. That includes a huge $640 million overseas. That makes it the highest grossing animated film in history overseas in the rest of the world. At number seven around the world is a two-way tie at $8 million. End of Watch, the Jake Gyllenhaal film. That's made $26 million so far. And The Bourne Legacy, another $8 million. That's at $224 million and counting. At number nine, another tie at $7 million. The horror film House at the End of the Street and Trouble with the Curve, the Clint Eastwood film, which is basically open only in North America. At number 10, we have a film that opened overseas a little bit before it comes here to the U.S. Liam Neeson's action film Taken 2 that made $6 million in a small opening around the world. And Madagascar 3 also made $6 million worldwide. A lot of ties this week. Again, at number 12, a two-way tie between Brave, the Pixar film, that's at now at $515 million, and Pitch Perfect, which is a limited release film in North America. I think it opened about 300 screens. It's a musical about sort of like Glee set in college. It's directed by Jason Ward, the director of the Broadway hit Avenue Q and Shrek the Musical. And until he got screwed out of it, he was part of Book of Mormon. But that made $5 million in limited release. So that's a movie to keep an eye on, as is The Master, which had another pretty good weekend. It made another $2.7 million. It's now at $9 million and counting.
And it's pretty much, I want to say, in limited release. I mean, this movie has not opened wide. It's opened wide for that type of movie, but it's not opened wide for, say, you know, an animated film.
Well, animated films can open limited as well. It's on a fair number of screens. It's not on 10 screens or 5 screens.
No,
it's, it's on, how many is it on? It's on 856 screens. Once upon a time, that was a damn wide release.
That's true. And I believe we call it Once Upon a Time the 1970s.
Or the 80s.
Yes, that's true.
In the 80s, it would started to be where you say, wow, 1,000 screens, and people would ooh and all. Also in limited release is The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which made another $1.1 million. It had an $11,000 per screen average. That's a very strong release for that movie, which we talked about before. And
Wait, that's based on a book written by who again?
Stephen Chbosky, I want to say. He's also the director of the film.
Yes, I just wanted you to say that name one more time.
Thanks. Thanks very much for that. So Hotel Transylvania did set a record for September. That's the big success story in North America. I wondered, of course, immediately what the 3D breakdown was, because we've seen 3D collapse in the last year. And surprisingly enough, we can't find out, which means the studio doesn't want to tell you how many people went to see it in 3D, because it's probably not good news. They don't even want to tell us how many screens it opened up in on 3D versus 2D. So the more poorly a movie does in 3D, the more they find that they're having a disparity and it's not looking good, the less information they're going to provide to the media outlets. We're at their mercy. If they don't tell us, we don't know.
Right. And we're assuming that because they didn't tell us, the news wasn't very good. And, you know, it's funny. I was meeting at a few studios over the last week, and one or two of these studio executives who work in distribution were saying, look, we know that effectively that when people go to the theater, they'll see the 2D version if that starts in 15 minutes, or they'll see the 3D version if that starts in 15 minutes. But whichever one starts a half an hour later, if there's a showing of that film before the 3D showing, they'll see it.
He's wrong.
Oh, you think people go directly to 3D?
No. Well, it depends on the movie. I think most of the time, families pick they don't just show up at a theater and decide what movie to see. Most of the time, people are in their cars or they're walking or they decide to see a movie and they pick the showtime for the screening they want to see. And they're avoiding 3D because they don't want to see 3D, not just because 2D happens to be there earlier. In fact, they aggressively seek out the movies that are on 2D screens even when there's a lot more showtimes in 3D. We saw that a couple months ago. If it's a big movie and they think The Hobbit is really worth seeing in 3D, as I imagine it is, I certainly want to see it that way just to see what it's like, I'm going to pick the showtime that has the 3D 48 frame per second showing. I'm going to avoid that. Just like I went to see The Master. I waited extra time because I didn't want to see it in digital. I wanted to see it in 70 millimeter. People pick the showtime based on the screening they want to see, or frankly, to save money. They go to a matinee if they have matinee prices, or they pick 2D because it's cheaper than 3D. So he's completely wrong on every level. He's in denial that people are rejecting 3D.
Well, actually, you know, Michael, there was a study done recently. I don't have the study in front of me. I know it was done by Stradella Road, which is Gordon Pattison's company, and he used to be the head of marketing over at, or at least digital marketing over at New Line Cinema, that said that people go to the movie theaters and more than 50% of them don't necessarily know what time the movie is that they're going to see, or they're making their decision as to what movie to see while standing in front of the box office.
Is that what you do?
Not at all, as a matter of fact.
Is that what I do?
Probably
not. Is that what anybody I've ever known does? No. So that makes no sense to me. They knew everybody who went to see Hotel Transylvania saw the ads and said, let's go see Hotel Transylvania. And in this day and age where it's so easy to get information on your phone or your computer or your newspaper or by phone, the idea that people go to a theater and mysteriously go, I wonder what's showing. Oh my God, the next screen is in an hour. Oh, well, I guess we'll sit around. That's not how it works. I don't know how that study was done, but it's not a good study because in practical experience, I've never known anyone who does that in my entire life, much less today, when the ability to know what's showing when is so rich. I will say, in an urban setting where people wander around and might physically just walk up or buy a theater and say, oh, hey, well, what's showing when? They want to figure out, or they see a show is sold out that they wanted to see, and then they go, all right, well, now what are other options? Sure. But, you know, you can only base from your personal experience, but I can't imagine a parent with three kids loading them in the car, going to a movie theater, parking, walking in, and saying, now what's showing and when are we going to see a movie? Really? That's not how it works. That doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. I don't buy it.
Well, I will look at this study. I know this is one of the studies where I saw this. I found the study as a PDF. I will download it and send it to you.
Oh, I have to do the work?
Well, I mean, I will highlight the page. How about that?
Okay, that's a good idea. We'll check it out. Okay. So I haven't seen Hotel Transylvania. Do you think it'll get an Oscar nomination? It's a big hit.
I'd have to see it first, but I'm going to think no on that. I'm going to go with no.
Why? Why? Did it get poor reviews or mixed reviews?
It got mixed reviews. And it stars Adam Sandler. I don't know if you're allowed to. I don't know if the Academy allows movies having to do with that. You know, that Adam Sandler has anything to do with to actually be nominated.
An animated film would be the perfect entree for him.
That's true. You know, little baby step for the Academy is what you're saying.
I imagine Punch Drunk Love got a nomination of some sort.
I knew when I said that, I was thinking to myself, oh, geez, did Punch Drunk Love get nominated for screenplay or something? Because if it did, I'm going to feel like an idiot.
So what do you think the options are this year for animated film?
Well, I think, you know, and this is coming from Glenn Whip of the Los Angeles Times. He's writing that maybe Disney might have not one, not two, but three films nominated for Best Animated Feature. So let's go through them. The first is Brave, which is the Pixar film, which is still in theaters, at least overseas. The second is Frankenweenie, or could be Frankenweenie. It has yet to open. Tim Burton's stop-motion film. It's in black and white. Not that that matters, really. And then finally, the CG animated Wreck-It Ralph. And this is the film about the video game. The video game character wants out of his video game.
Right.
And it looks kind of fun, actually, that film.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about the Tim Burton film. It feels a little been there, done that. And the early reviews said the same thing, that it feels like he's sort of going over. But, you know, he's a huge success story. Obviously, Oscar loves him. So it's not out of the question.
No, not at all.
I guess the question is, what kind of competition do they have? The Aardman film, The Pirates, Band of Misfits, was cute. But I don't know if people are going to remember it. Paranorman, that stop-motion animated film, could have a shot, maybe.
This is the one by Laika, the same group that did Coraline?
That's right. We haven't seen Rise of the Guardians yet. That's coming out soon. And
I've seen a lot of Rise of the Guardians. This is the DreamWorks animation film that is kind of like, I don't know, I think Glenn Whip calls it the Avengers for children, because it's like, you know, the Tooth Fairy, Santa Claus, Jack Frost, you know.
Does it seem more popular? Does it seem like it's really smart, well done?
It seems like it could be too intellectual, frankly.
For the Oscars? Or for kids?
For kids.
Right, but do you think it'd have an Oscar shot if it comes off well?
If it comes off well, possibly, yes, because it's got a lot of talent behind it.
Well, we'll have to see. As you know, they're obviously a big player. They've got three good films, so they're in the mix.
Yeah, and Ice Age and Madagascar 3, you know, those films never really received any love from the Academy.
Nor do they deserve it. And the Lorax is poor as well. I don't think that will do anything.
Yeah, and Glenn Whip here was saying that maybe G-Kids, which is Gorilla Kids International Distribution Syndicate, this is an animation feature distribution firm that has released recent Academy Award Best Feature Animation nominees, such as A Cat in Paris, Chico and Rita, and The Secret of Kells. Now, none of those won the Best Animated Feature Award, but they were, and they're more geared towards adults rather than children, and they're animated in traditional hand-drawn animation. But they're doing quite well when it comes to racking up nominations.
Well, you brought it up, so I'm going to force to ask you the question. Do they have something set to come out this year?
Do they have something set to come out this year? That would be a big, I don't know. That's a good question. I'd have to go back and check.
Because if they don't, it seems less likely.
That's true. Actually, I do think they have something set to come out, but I can't remember what it is. I'd have to go back and look.
Well, they have Tales of the Night, a new animated film by the director of Azur and Asmar, which was a terrific animated film. So it's possible. I know that's playing at the IFC. They seem to be the distributor. Whether it's eligible or all that sort of stuff, I assume it is, and that they will nominate it, because it's he's a real talent, and I keep meaning to get down to the IFC to check it out myself. But that is scheduled for this year, along with a movie called A Letter to Momo. So they have some possibilities that look like they will be eligible, and they'll be in the mix.
Well, this wouldn't be the first time that Disney scored a hat trick, as it's being called here, and got nominated with three films in the Best Animated Feature category at the Oscars. They did that in 2002 when they saw Lilo and Stitch, Treasure Planet, and Hayao Miyazaki's Spirited Away. And I think that actually won, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it did. That was a classic.
Yeah,
if you have kids
movie.
And you're looking for a movie to watch, that is a great movie. Lilo and Stitch is okay. Treasure Planet really didn't deserve it, but there weren't many other options available to Oscar, I imagine, at that year. Because otherwise, why would that be in the mix?
That's right. Well, now speaking of options, that brings us to our music news. And Neil Young, rocker Neil Young, you know, of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Buffalo Springfield, and he of Crazy Horse fame.
That's right.
Yeah, well, he is, you know, driving rock stars and anybody who will sit down long enough around in his Cadillac Eldorado playing a new sound format that he has helped develop, which is called Pono. Well, the service is called Pono, and it's a high-resolution music service, and it's really been designed to combat this inferiority that MP3s have to offer. And that's something that he's been banging that drum for quite some time.
Let's set the stage here.
Okay.
Albums came out, then they went to cassettes, which were a vastly inferior source of music, but they were portable and light and easy, and you could put them in the car, better than 8-track. People loved them, huge success story. Neil Young hated them. Then came the compact disc, which a lot of people thought was much better. In the early days of compact discs, remastering them properly was a difficult art. People didn't know how to do it, and you'd get albums that would sound substantially worse than their LP version.
That's
you know,
right.
They didn't do a good job mastering them. They were too bright. They're too hard. This, that, and the other thing. They just didn't do a great job with the capabilities that CD had. That has clearly improved over the years. But even then, even at their best, Neil Young and some other people would say there's a warmth, there's a feel to analog to the LP that is superior to what you have on the compact disc. I hate it. And he fought CDs for years. He didn't want to see his albums come out on CDs. Eventually, he put out a box set on Blu-ray in a desperate desire to find some format that he felt was acceptable. He ended up with this box set of Blu-ray discs. So Blu-ray audio, it obviously, is not the format that's taken over the world. He wasn't exactly sold on it, but it was the best he could find. And it was a way to make a stand against compact discs, which he hated so much. He's a tinkerer. He's got an electric car he's been working on for 5 or 7 years.
Wait, he's got an electric car. This is the guy that drives a Cadillac Eldorado.
He's got an electric car. He's got a company building electric cars. He's been working it for years. He's been filming it. The car burst into flames, not because of any problems with the electrical car parts, but because someone left a blowtorch near the batteries. So it wasn't a setback technically. It was just a setback, you know, in literal terms. But he's been filming this project for years. He's passionate about electric cars and alternative energy. He created a system for helping to arrange trains on train sets because he's been a big toy train set, if that's the proper phrase. And so he has actually partnered with Lionel Trains. So this guy has a lot of mechanical, technical experience. He's always been passionate about it in a lot of different areas. And he set out and said, this sucks. MP3s suck. They sound terrible. Even the best MP3s, you know, even at a higher bit rate, they don't sound good. We need something else. I want people to be able to listen to music and hear it the way I hear it when I'm in the studio listening to that master. We've got as much information as possible. It sounds amazing. When you hear what's on the master, even the best compact disc or LP or MP3 cannot match what the artist hears in the studio. And in fact, on recent remasterings of like the Beatles, Paul and Ringo would say things like, wow, I'm hearing things I remember hearing in the studio. This is closer to what we heard when we said the album is done. You're finally hearing it a little bit like what we heard in the studio. It's as if someone made a movie and then nobody ever got to see that movie. There was always something getting in the way.
Well, it's I always liken it to, you know, for those who are more visually inclined, imagine seeing a film, a movie in the theater, and it's crisp and clear and bright. Then, you know, you watch it on VHS and immediately then watch that same movie on DVD and then immediately watch it on Blu-ray. You can actually see from VHS to Blu-ray the difference in resolution.
That's right. And so the argument is, with this SQS, Studio Quality Service?
It's Studio Quality Sound.
Sound.
And he writes all about this in his new book, Neil Young, that is, Waging Heavy Peace. And, you know,
it's a biography, essentially.
Right. And Weijin
Hideki, rambling biography.
Well, you know, I would expect nothing less. Is it in a high pitched voice? Because a falsetto, maybe? Weijin Hideki piece refers to, when Neil Young kind of started talking about this new sound format, everybody said, oh, you're going to wage war against Apple. And so I guess he named the book Waging Heavy Peace rather than Waging War.
So it's a new standard for digital music.
Right. And it's.
And he's making it available to anyone. Anybody who wants to use it can use it. He's not trying to profit particularly from SQS. He has this company that's going to sell MP3 players. Like,
well, not MP3 players. They will sell players that can play this particular format. That's Pono.
Digital players, I beg your pardon.
Yes. Now, so, part of the problem is that digital, when you really start talking about digital is either on or it's off. Whereas sound itself is a waveform, so it's never off. It's, you know, when you pluck the string of a guitar, it doesn't go on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off to make the sound. It just vibrates, and it's constantly vibrating. So when you translate that analog sound into digital, you actually have to start turning that into ones and zeros, which then get put back together at the other end of the speaker and turned into a waveform again, into analog.
Well, he's just saying, I'm trying to keep better resolution, better sound, better than any uncompressed file you've ever heard, right?
Right.
He's got a new standard. How is he doing with it?
Well, better fidelity.
Right. He's doing a better job of it. Are the record labels on board?
They are on board. All three major record labels, Warner Music Group, Universal Music Group, and Sony Music.
It doesn't take long to get them on board. There are only three of them.
That's right. Well, Warner has already converted 8,000 album titles to this high resolution. Now, just to give you some sense, it's 192 kilohertz sound. So that's the bit rate. The bit depth is 24-bit sound. So it's 24-bit sound.
None of us know what any of that means. Okay, so it's a nice number.
Well, but here's the thing. Just to give you some perspective, the CD is recorded at 16-bit sound.
Okay.
Okay. And DVD is recorded at 24-bit sound. And okay. So what we're talking about is the number of bits in a sample. And a sample is a moment in time. So just on that sine wave, when you pluck that guitar string, it's going up and down that sine wave. There are moments in time, and each moment is 16, or in this case, 24 bits. And
right. Oh my God, yes. Okay.
Okay. So now just follow me, because this is where it gets kind of, you know.
It doesn't have to.
It doesn't have to.
The standard CD is 44.1, and this is 196. It's four times as big.
Right, so basically,
so it's better.
By sampling, instead of there being 44,100 samples per second, okay, there will be 192,000 samples per second per track.
Why not 300,000 samples per track?
Because at some point, the actual audio gear can't handle it anymore. So, you know, and as we pointed out when we were doing our pre-show, the human ear can't tell the difference. And that's what MP3 was supposed to do, was it was compressing all of this down to, I think, you know, 160 kilobits per second, usually 16-bit audio. And, you know, what they were saying is, look, your ear isn't going to tell the difference between anything below a certain level and anything above a certain level. So we'll just squash all that down into this mid-range, and it will take a 50-megabyte file, wave file, and squish it down into...
Oh, my God, stop with the numbers.
It'll just, you know... But now with you know, these hard drives costing so little, memory is so inexpensive, why not make each song 50 megabytes instead of 4?
And why not sell that Bob Dylan album yet again? But basically, the record labels are saying, you've got this format and you think people will buy our albums all over again, just like they did on LP, cassette, and CD? Great!
That's right, yeah. And you know, what I think is interesting is this guy, Neil Young, is so, he's kind of such a, I don't know what you would...
Hippie?
Well, zealot about this? Zealot is the wrong word, but he's...
No, that's about right.
Well, okay. Well, he had this concert film recently, and it was released by Sony, and Sony was releasing it digitally, and he said, look, I understand that the Digital Cinema Initiative's DCI, the specification calls for 24-bit sound, 48K. And he said, yeah, I don't want that. I want 96 kilohertz at 24-bit. The problem is, nobody could play it. So he made Sony jump through all these hoops, and then one or two theaters had equipment that was capable of playing it.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
Right. Well,
So it's a new service. It's a new sound standard, which he's licensing basically for free or open source, or what's he doing with the specs?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think he's just letting people use it. I mean, as was mentioned in Rolling Stone in the article we linked to here, says he's not doing it for any commercial reason.
Right. The Pono, the service that will sell stuff, that could make money. But the actual sound standard, he's just hoping everyone adopts it and use it. And if Apple would adopt it, great. The problem, of course, that we don't know, it's like I have an iPhone. I get WAV files, which are fairly uncompressed sound files. They're much bigger than most MP3 files, even at a high sampling rate. Sometimes I get an album sent to me, and I take it in the WAV format, WAV, which is what record radio stations are encouraged to use when they're playing a record.
Right, you know, because it's better quality. It's lossless, as opposed to...
Right, but so if I take that lossless format of WAV and I put it on my phone, it takes up like half the phone.
That's right, so, yeah, they're huge. Like a whole album could be like 500 megabytes.
Any idea why SQS is so much better than this lossless format that we've had for a while that radio stations use to play music digitally?
Well, first of all, it's 24 bits and 122 kilohertz, so... That in and of itself means there's just going to be more data there to turn.
But how can they be lossless if there's data lost?
Well, effectively, what WAV files are doing is they're taking all the silence and just throwing it out and not storing that. I would have to really get into the tech specs. Yeah, I'm not going to do that because I'd have to actually read the tech specs right now and to answer that question.
So the best turnout would be if record labels and cloud people like Amazon, we've already seen Amazon and some others say, hey, store your stuff in the cloud and we'll upconvert it to the best quality master that we have. If their best quality master was SQS and you could stream a much better sound file, everybody would be a winner.
Right. But then would you have to buy it again? And I think that's...
You don't have to buy it when they upconvert it. That's my whole point. When you put your stuff on Amazon and they say, all right, this is an older version of the album, we're not going to go find a crappier version of this album. We're going to use the high quality mastering that we have right now, that's the version you're going to have access to. So people got a free conversion to the better sounding quality that happens today. So there's no reason why they couldn't do that with SQS.
Yeah. And I like what Jim James, the lead singer of My Morning Jacket, had to say to Rolling Stone. He says, Neil's premise is cool. And I think it's exciting as a traveling musician. I think that's somewhere that he has to be careful. I've already brought Aretha Franklin's respect a lot of times. Do I have to buy it again?
Well, it's not Neil Young who has to be careful. It's the record labels. They think, oh, great. Maybe they tried with CD audio and Super CD and Blu-ray audio. They thought we'd buy all our albums all over again that way. That didn't work.
No, they thought that we'd buy it on mini disc. That didn't
work. Yeah, mini disc, DAT, you name it. So there you go. So we got to wait. A fair number of artists have signed on. I don't know if the Beatles have signed on.
I was just going to ask you. I know you're a huge Beatles fan, and I know you bought all of their box set when they came out with the remastered records in 2009, and you bought the mono version.
Yep, yep.
And now my question is, now they're going backwards. So they started with albums. They went all the way to CDs, then to digital, finally to digital in 2009, 2010. Now they're going backwards, back to vinyl, and they're going to have a new remastered box set of vinyl LPs. I guess Amazon is pricing it at $400 for pre-order, and individual titles are going to sell for somewhere between $25 and $30 here in the U.S. Are you going to buy any of these vinyl LPs?
Actually just buy some albums for their covers, specifically Richard and Linda Thompson and Prefab Sprout, because they were available in mint condition, beautiful versions. I did actually buy them just to display the album covers.
I'm sorry, can you go back and explain to me what an album cover is? I'm a little lost.
So I bought some of these artists that I'm personally very fond of. I wanted to have them. I knew this library collection was available, and I knew I'd want certain albums, and I got them. But I don't collect album covers generally. I have a couple hundred that I bought just for the cover. So I don't buy new albums, and I don't buy mint or first print. All I care about is the cover image being nice. So in this case, no, I wouldn't buy the Beatles. I wouldn't mind having those covers because they're great. But I'm not going to spend $400 on an LP. I don't even have a turntable. And right. Of course, people say, oh, the album is coming back. I saw that online about a story about...
You mean the vinyl LP.
Right, the vinyl is coming back. It's not coming back. Last year, they sold 3.9 million copies of LPs, period.
Right. Well, and you ask what the difference is between, say, digital and vinyl. Well, the reality these days is that most of the master tapes have been converted to digital. So they've taken those analog waves and turned them into ones and zeros. And that's exactly what the Beatles did. And they have these 24-bit, 192 kilohertz, 192,000 samples per second digital masters. And that's what they go back to. They don't go back to the tapes. They go back to the digital masters. So that's as good as you can get.
Right. So if you love LPs, it'll be nice.
Right.
But don't kid yourself and think the LP is making a comeback. Not so. It's a strictly tiny, tiny, tiny niche, you know, audiophile market.
Right. For people who are electronic dance music DJs.
Well, I've got a Victrola, but that's not coming back either.
Do you also have one of those Bolex cameras that you hand crank?
I do.
And look
what about MySpace? Is MySpace coming back?
Ooh, good question. You know, I have no idea. I mean, certainly from looking at this trailer that they've placed online, the redesign, the relaunch of this website, it looks kind of interesting.
It looks like Facebook.
Yes, it does, actually.
It looks like a Facebook for music. You can post things about concerts you went to, link to your friends, share notes, share DJ set lists, that sort of thing. It looks essentially like they want everybody to hang out there and talk about music all the time.
Right. It's basically a fan and artist social hub so that if you're, well, they use Justin Timberlake since he is now an investor in MySpace along with the company Specific Media, which purchased the company 2 years ago for $35 million, which, by the way, was only a small portion of the $580 million that News Corp paid for MySpace back in 2005.
I would feel so good if I was part of the sale in 2005. Ha ha! You talk about getting out at the right time.
Yeah, and so bad if you were a part of it in, say, 2010 when it sold for $35 million. But Justin Timberlake was a part of that. He got a piece of the company, and they're using you know, him as an example of, you know, here's an artist who's talking to fans through MySpace, who's posting clips and pictures and videos and tracks for people to listen to. So it'll be interesting. It looks great. I have to say, it really does. The design looks amazing. But can a brand that was once dead, or, you know, brand that was once alive, then pretty much killed off by Facebook, can it come back?
You know, it's hard. But where do you hang out to talk about music online? You can, if you're on Spotify or Pandora, I think it automatically posts to Facebook and says, oh, this is what you're listening to right now.
That's right.
That's great. And you can go to Pandora or Spotify or some of the others. And I guess there are forums and areas. Is that where you hang out to talk about music, or where do you go?
How about going to a concert? That seems to be like a natural venue to hang out and talk about music.
We're talking about online, sarcastic man. Well, I'd say there's still a place, there's still a possibility to have a forum where people want to hang out and talk about books or movies or theater or music. I don't know if there's a really strong one online right now for music. MySpace, obviously the brand is dead, but still memorable. So,
well, and I wonder if you can resurrect a brand. You know, Marissa Meyer's trying to do it at Yahoo. And I wonder if MySpace can be resurrected and kind of transform itself into something that it once was and now needs to be again.
I don't think it's out of the question. I never used it except to find tracks by artists. You know, if I heard about an artist's name and I wanted to check them out, I knew they'd be on MySpace and I could hear two or three or four or five tracks from their most recent album. That's how I used it. Would I do that again if MySpace was active again? Sure, why not, I guess. People go to YouTube now for that as much as anything. But you could get like three or four or five tracks easily from a new album. So it sort of was an easier way to sample an artist than YouTube is. So I'd be up for it.
So are you going to sign up to be notified when the new MySpace launches?
No.
No. Okay, so you don't think it's a big deal then that they even announced this?
No, not now. They released an ad. Who cares?
Okay.
Show it. Let me see it when it's up and running.
All right. Then
do we even know when that'll be?
We have no idea. Soon. I believe it's soon, which I'm looking on the calendar now and I can't find where soon is. Is that a month or a day? I don't know.
That was soon, but now is Big Deal, Big Whoop.
That's right. And Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. It's the latest Hollywood trend. Find a talented director, get them to launch or reboot a valuable franchise, and then announce a hasty sequel and kick the director off the project when they balk. Studios did it with Gary Ross and the Hunger Games sequel. They almost did it with Mark Webb and the last Spider-Man reboot, though he's back on board. And now they're reportedly also doing it with the sequel to Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the James Franco reboot that was critically acclaimed. I think it was, in 2011? It was an Oscar hopeful and a box office hit. The new film is going to be called Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and Fox doesn't have an official director or even, say, an official script that they're excited about. But they do have something they value even more than both of those things, and that is a release date. Yes, this sequel, without a script or a director, is coming out May 23rd, 2014, so you can go and buy your tickets now. And it's going to come out come hell or high water. That prompted director Rupert Wyatt to balk, so Fox is lining up the usual suspects to find a new director. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
A big deal. It's letting the release date, you know, it's the tail wagging the dog, letting release date stand in for everything and control what happens is just stupid. If a movie is a successful property, people will want to see it when you release it. You don't need to, they all want to claim release dates so desperately that they're putting that ahead of creating a good movie. It's just a dumb, long-term way to do business.
Well, now, some would say, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, hey, a movie is a product, and what Fox is a manufacturing company, and they need product to release into the market to earn revenue. And so what they're doing is they're saying, we would like new product, our new product, to come out on a specific day or in a specific time frame. Much the way Apple does when they say they need a new iPhone every September. You know, they're basically aiming to hit a target. It's 2 years from now, a year and a half from now. What's so bad about that? Now, I would, of course, you know, not playing devil's advocate, I'd say that might be fine when you're manufacturing hard goods. It may not be as good when you're manufacturing at something as subjective as art.
Right. There's a big difference between a book, a play, a movie, and a hammer.
Right.
So, you know, yes, you always need to have a stream of product. You need to always be, you know, ready to have new movies to release. You need a release schedule. You need movies in the pipeline and coming out. But you also remember, hey, sometimes it takes longer than this. Sometimes something else is shorter. Something else, you know, you've got to be flexible and ready to deal with the creative process in order to make sure you don't tarnish a billion-dollar franchise by a hastily ill-thought-out sequel.
Now, that being said, if you don't have a hammer and you need to nail something in, you can use a heavy book.
That's true.
Now, not all sports programming is created equal. We talked last week and a couple of episodes ago, recently, that is, about the massive amount of money baseball has pulled in from TV channels for access to all of its game, for its broadcast rights. Hockey may be in the exact opposite situation. First, regular season games usually pull in, you know, a modest 600,000 viewers. And by modest, I mean I'm kind of being polite. And even Game 4 of the Stanley Cup last year peaked at 2 million viewers.
Even Honey Boo Boo gets a bigger audience than that.
That's right. You know, hockey desperately needs to win back viewers and entice new fans. So here's what they're doing. What do you think they're doing? The players are going on strike, and the players and owners are unable to come to terms, and the entire season, the entire hockey season right now, is on hold and possibly in danger of being scrapped due to this strike. Big deal or big what, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. It's fun watching an entire sport, you know, implode. And I think it's interesting because of how it affects a cable channel. NBC Sports is a new cable channel. Everybody wants their own cable channel. CBS Sports, NBC Sports, Fox. They have regional and national cable channels. They're all competing with ESPN, which is a huge, huge franchise that makes a ton of money. And they all want in on the business. The problem is there aren't enough sports to go around.
That's right.
Women's soccer, non-Olympics, isn't really pulling in big crowds. And that's what you see on NBC Sports and CBS Sports, if you scroll through their weekly schedule. There's also the Big Ten Network. So NBC Sports has built themselves around hockey. They took over Versus, which was the earlier version of this sports channel. Their big brand was bull riding. Now you can't find bull riding on cable TV regularly. You have to go to Yahoo to watch bull riding, which drives me nuts.
I just saw it on NBC yesterday.
It's spotty.
Okay.
There's a weekly season of like 10 months, 11 months. They almost never stop riding bulls and risking their neck. And you used to be able to watch stuff every single week, all three parts of the event. Now you can maybe catch Friday night on CBS Sports, and then maybe Saturday or Sunday might be on a network or not at all. It's very frustrating, and it's got to be hurting the sport. Hockey is going to be in the same problem. So NBC bought Versus. They renamed it the NBC Sports Network. They dumped bull riding because they thought that was too hicky. And now they've got hockey, but unfortunately, they have no hockey. So they've got this brand new channel, just branded as NBC Sports, hoping to make it a big part of the cable universe, and they don't have anything to show. So it's really going to put a crimp in NBC Sports, and their money that they spent to buy Versus, the money that they spent to buy hockey, the money that they spent to try and launch this network, it could be dead in the water.
Michael, this just in, I'm being told by our breaking news desk that we have some last-minute news. Thank you very much for the audio cue there. Seth MacFarlane, the creator of Family Guy and the writer-director of the hit comedy, the international hit comedy, Ted, he will be hosting the Academy Awards, the Oscars, that's right. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
The first reaction, of course, is, what a bad idea.
Especially for a guy who just last week walked out onto the Emmy stage and started talking and
couldn't find the mic.
And he was in totally the wrong place. He had to walk across the entire stage live on camera and then say, oh, the mic's over here. I guess next time I should come to rehearsal. And then halfway through his presentation said, you know, this is going to be on YouTube now, right?
Well, that was what they would consider a save.
That's right.
A self-deprecating comment. So that's all right. He doesn't have a lot of experience on camera, so he's not a natural host. Every time I've seen him on a talk show or an award show, he's smiling too much. He looks awkward. He doesn't look comfortable. His whole humor base is snarky, sarcasm, and all that sort of stuff. That's exactly the tone you don't want for the Academy Awards. So he seems like a terrible choice. Don't you agree?
Well, here's the thing. I think going with somebody who's not kind of a showman in the,
somebody who's been on air and on camera on a live event.
Or at the very least on stage. I mean, you know, you pointed out, I think when we talked about this before, Matthew Broderick, Bette Midler, these are all Craig Zaden and Neil Marin are producing the Oscars. Those are people he could have gone with. He could have gone with John Waters, who hosts the Independent Spirit Awards. He's a wonderful filmmaker and who's wonderful when he hosts those things. The Spirit Awards, that is. And instead, they went with Seth MacFarlane. I think they're doing this because, let's face it, Ted is an enormous hit.
No. They're putting him on the show because Ted is a hit?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. No, they're not. They put him on the show because they think he's going to be a good host.
Well, don't you think that if Ted was
You don't become a good host of a live televised event in front of 100 million people because you've directed a comedy.
Well,
it doesn't work.
Let me ask you this. If Ted was a flop, do you think they'd be putting him on?
He's hot. He's hot, but that's not why you think he's a good host.
No, I don't think he's. I mean, maybe his smile. I mean, he's the smile.
If that's their thinking, well, he's made a hit comedy. I guess people want to tune into the Oscars now. That's ridiculous. Yeah, that's an idiotic way to think.
Well, you know, they've been trying to make the Oscars and the Oscar telecast a bit more edgy. And I don't know. I mean, you're talking about Ted. This is the foul-mouthed teddy bear movie, as you called it, Michael.
Obviously, the teddy bear will be there. There'll be a joke about the teddy bear. He'll pop up at a dais and do a joke or two. It'll be hilarious.
Right. Well,
but you know, he does perform. He does sing standards. It goes around the jazz band or an orchestra, I think, frankly. So, you know, maybe he's got more stage experience than we think. Maybe he'll pull it off. God knows he'll sing and we'll see the teddy bear, but you know, you wish him the best, but it seems like a bad idea. However, expectations will be low.
You may have to eat humble pie come Oscar night.
I wish him the best.
Well, will the Kindle device devoted to just reading become a thing of the past? It seems like every tablet worth its salt is expanding its offerings from the Kindle Fire to the Nook. The Barnes & Noble tablet is now offering, get this, Michael, Nook Video, because we don't have enough video services, both for its own device, so this service will be for its own device, and as an app, probably, presumably, downloadable on, say, iOS or the Android platform. You can buy and watch movies and TV shows via Nook Video, and you can hook up your tablet or your device to your own ultraviolet library or account. And you can stream all the stuff that you own. Ultraviolet is the online locker the major studios are supporting for digital copies in your library, by the way. This makes it easier to start watching on a Nook and then seamlessly pick up the film at home or on your laptop or your smart TV. Is this Nook Video service a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big whoop. One more service. Who cares? No information. How many titles are available? How many studios are participating? How many TV shows? How many movies? We don't know anything about it. So, big whoop.
All of the titles are available except for the ones that are not. And the first renewal of the new TV season. That's right. The TV season is a week old and there's already been a renewal. NBC has jumped all over the successful fall debut of The Voice and renewed it for what they term the fourth and fifth season. Actually, that just means that, like Survivor and other reality shows, the singing competition will come back next year and have the complete contest both in the spring and in the fall. That's not exactly earth-shaking news, in my opinion, since The Voice is, you know, NBC's second biggest hit right after football, and they'd already announced Shakira and Usher would be judges in the spring, so big deal or big whoop, Michael.
Yeah, it's... We've got new judges for the spring show, and there will be a spring show.
That's right.
They put the cart before the horse on this one. It's a little silly. The big problem for The Voice, and I think the judges have good chemistry. They got to have good chemistry with the new judges, and that matters even more on this show because they certainly aren't finding talent.
Ooh.
Nobody on The Voice has even come close to having a hit single or a hit album. So until they launch talent, until they get a Kelly Clarkson, a Carrie Underwood, you know, the dozens of people who have been successful.
A Ruben Studdard. Come on, admit you wanted
Ruben
to say
Studdard
it.
Had 3 or 4 or 5 albums. He's still touring cabarets. He had a good success, and Clay Aiken also had big success.
That's right.
No one's going to, doesn't mean you have a 20-year career, but they launched careers, and they have found talented people who won Grammys and Emmys and Oscars. I'm sorry, I'm not sure about the Emmy. Did Fantasia win an Emmy? They've had success on Broadway, at the movies, and most importantly, in the music, and they've proven it again and again. The Voice hasn't done it. How excited are you going to be 2 years from now if they keep having a show and keep finding people who then disappear forever? At some point, they got to make their bona fides.
I can actually really put this argument to rest. Let me ask you this. Who won the first season of The Voice?
I don't know.
There you go. End of discussion. You don't know. Whereas if I said that about American Idol, you'd say?
Kelly Clarkson.
There you go. Everyone knows magazines and newspapers are attracting readers online. We all know that. But how many? And how much should advertisers be paying for them? Some magazines have added digital-only subscriptions to the total figures they promise to advertisers, and that's known as the rate base, as in, we will bring you X number of readers every issue. Advertisers in the print edition naturally call, hey, no way, this is foul. How can the magazines claim readers online when those people will never see the ads they are paying to run in the physical magazine? Now The Economist has stepped forward to change that. Of course, The Economist is one of the more successful brands online, and it's now offering a physical rate base and a separate rate base for its digital edition. This new rate does not include people with physical editions who also get access to the digital edition. So if you follow me there, if you get both...
Right, you buy the New Yorker, you have access to it online. That wouldn't count as a second subscription.
Correct. It does not include single issue sales, which I don't know why. I mean, if
well, because you can't promise them week to week.
Oh, okay. It doesn't include people who go to their website. So that's another thing. It doesn't include quite a bit, actually. It does include, however, a guarantee of the number of people who subscribe to the digital-only version of the magazine. They appear to be the first magazine or newspaper to reflect the new digital reality. So is it a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's a coming of age for the digital version of magazines, which have struggled, not been nearly as successful as people thought. Essentially, they're paying a lot of money to convert stuff and offering it as an added inducement to keep subscribers. But in certain cases, if they're successful, like The Economist, they can say, hey, we've got a digital rate base, and that matters to advertisers.
You mean a rate base.
A rate base. And it matters to readers because it means the money that they spend supporting that format is not being wasted, and that they're going to be reflected and part of the business. And that means The Economist is more likely to survive. So it's good for everybody.
The publishing house Pearson offers a lot of technical manuals, and now they're offering a deal to readers. When you prepay for a book, you can receive an early draft of the final work in ebook form 60 to 90 days before the official publication date, while it's in the midst of editing and technical reviews and production. Then when the book comes out, they'll receive an update with the ebook in the final form. Sexy titles in the early edition program include the Core iOS 6 Developer's Cookbook.
Ooh.
Learning iCloud Data Management.
Ooh.
And this is probably my favorite. Programming in Objective-C 5th Edition.
Oh, I so want that.
Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I thought it was a big deal, but I think I'm wrong. Sperling?
Well, we kind of talked about this during the pre-show. This is something that has been done by Safari Books, another kind of tech publishing company that publishes, you know, O'Reilly and all of the tech manuals, so to speak. They've been doing this for at least 2 to 3 years on Safari Books Online or Creative Edge.
Now, people in these technical manual areas are sort of on the digital envelope, digital edge. They're pushing the possibilities. Some companies, if you buy a hardcover edition, they will give you the digital edition free, as they should, especially for something like this. So that's an interesting innovation that others haven't picked up yet. But technical manual people seem to be willing to push the edge. What I don't understand is, however, don't you really need it to be edited properly? I mean, if you're giving technical advice, isn't that an area where you really don't want a rough draft? I mean, a rough draft of the new J.K. Rowling book might be fascinating, but a rough draft of a technical manual?
Yeah, I never understood. I thought, well, great, so...
Did we say 350 degrees? We meant 75.
Right.
Oopsie. Did you just destroy your computer? But I think it's interesting. And frankly, they could be... I don't think it's the intent, but they could be crowdsourcing their editing. You know, if they release it to hardcore people who are buying these books early, the people will probably email them back and say, hey, people doing core iOS 6 developers cookbook, on page 72, you did this and you should say that, or you're missing this step or something like that. It could turn out to be a really lucrative and valuable resource that they're tapping into here.
Beach Boy Mike Love isn't feeling the love. The band led by Brian Wilson is having a smash 50th anniversary tour right now. And I know, Michael, you went to see it several times. It was better than Cats. You'd see it again and again.
I've never seen the Beach Boys. I would have, though I think their time has passed. So I probably wouldn't go because they're too old. But you know, I love the Beach Boys.
Well, Love has already announced he'll go back on the road next year. So you'll get a chance to see him after, you know, this current tour is over, with a pickup band under the Beach Boys moniker, which, by the way, he controls. In other words, before the final show of this current tour, he's already made clear he'll keep cashing in on the Beach Boys name, and Wilson and the other original members, like Al Jardine and David Marks, they're not invited. In essence, it's the touring version of the Beach Boys that Love used before this big reunion tour. Wilson had thought they might record some new music and was actually distraught about the whole thing. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. Nobody's going to be confused. It's what he was doing for years, just touring around. He was the only original member in this touring band. So he's just kind of a jerk. He was a jerk at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He was a jerk on this tour. I mean, they've got one show left. Why are you announcing this now? Why are you throwing it in their face? There's no need to do it. Instead, he's just being as obnoxious as possible. So, and he dissed the Eagles, who were very unhappy about that. They slapped him back for his comments about the Eagles reunion tour. It just shows, you know, they come together for money on the 50th anniversary, but they didn't actually mend a lot of fences.
That's true. They did play the Grammys, and I think a lot of people went, wow, they're old.
Yeah.
Well, it took her almost 4 years and a presidential election that seems to have energized Democrats more than Republicans, but MSNBC's Rachel Maddow has finally beaten Fox News's Sean Hannity in the weekly demo that matters to advertisers, the 25 to 54 age group. Maddow scored an average of 567,000 viewers compared to Hannity's 500,000 viewers, so only 67,000 more, but still more. Both are far ahead of CNN's Piers Morgan's, and this is the remarkable number. Piers Morgan's average is 198,000. That's
CNN is in the basement.
Yeah, the big TV news story of the week was the Mitt Romney video from a fundraiser, a story that MSNBC covered extensively in which Fox News notably downplayed a great deal. In fact, I think they said, video? What video? Big deal or big what, Michael?
I think it's a big deal because of that reason why she might have pulled ahead. There was a big news story. Fox News made a decision, a political one, I would say, to not cover it. And so MSNBC benefited from that. And if Fox learns their lesson, they're going to be less likely to do that in the future. And that's an important thing. It's useful. It's good for TV news or TV pundits, if you will, because since a lot of them are not doing news so much as just bloviating about the news. But it's a big step forward for MSNBC. It's a big step back for Fox News. And it might get them to rethink their game plan as far as how much they're going to tailor what they do in prime time based on a political agenda rather than letting the news drive what they talk about.
Wow.
And that's why it matters to viewers.
Good point. Jeremy Jordan. Now, this is a story that we were putting in because Michael has some explaining to do. You might remember Jeremy Jordan as he's like the hit, you know, he's Broadway's it boy right now. He became a Broadway star when he originated not one but two different original parts in Broadway musicals last season. The fall flop Bonnie and Clyde, and then in the spring, he was in the smash Newsies. As far as we know, that had never been done before and certainly not in a very long time. Toss in the fact that Jordan is a handsome devil, according to some people, and you've got yourself a new bankable name. Jordan immediately headed to the NBC drama series Smash, the sort of platform that can add even bigger bankability to your name, not to mention more money and possibly more film roles. Still, he'd only been in one hit, and Newsies was a name brand musical that had been an out-of-the-box smash from its very first preview. So what happened? Since Jordan left, Newsies has quickly fallen from the $1 million club and to about $800,000 a week in grosses. So the $1 million club is when you make $1 million a week, week in, week out. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because I was wrong and I should admit it. I did not imagine the show would take a financial hit, maybe a very brief 1 week hit, but it's actually been substantial. It's like a 20% drop in revenue. They're still selling a lot of tickets, 96, 98% capacity full. So there's people in the seats. They're just not paying as much money for the tickets. So I guess they're going more, a little bit more to, you know, TDF and the discount web services. So it's still a big hit. It's still doing well. Last week it was at 800,000. This week it's at 848,000, which is, you know, 20% lower than a million, or 18%, 15%. So it's a drop.
You fault me for mentioning all these numbers?
So, my bad. So they're losing 200,000 a week. That's not a good sign. It is a good sign for Jeremy Jordan, though. I think the show's going to be fine long term, but it does show that Jeremy Jordan is a draw on Broadway.
Well, I know that Pandora has a Broadway channel where you can listen to all the Broadway hits. I never seem to hear anything other than Phantom of the Opera and Les Mis on that channel, but maybe they'll throw in a few Jeremy Jordan tracks and from Newsies and when we can hear that. But that is actually the subject of our Inside Baseball segment this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, they actually may affect you because this week's topic is about the royalty rates paid for online streaming. Specifically, we're going to talk about Pandora, which is effectively online radio. You can't say, go and give me a specific song. You can say, give me Broadway hits, or give me 1980s pop songs, or give me, movie soundtracks. And then they'll create a whole radio station around that with songs that are similar. Well, working its way through Congress right now is the Internet Radio Fairness Act, which is being co-sponsored by Representatives Chavits and Polis. And it's seeking to bring royalty rate equality across both satellite radio, radio on cable TV, and online radio.
As well as terrestrial radio.
Well, it doesn't say terrestrial radio, and I don't think it is terrestrial radio because it's the Internet Radio Fairness Act.
Okay, I thought it would be to bring internet radio in line with terrestrial radio, but that's not the case necessarily.
No, and at the very least, what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, okay, satellite, you pay 8% of all your revenue. So at SiriusXM, you make $100 million, you're paying $8 million to ASCAP and, you know, all the artists and record companies.
That's the deal that they made with each individual record label, or how did they make that deal?
I think that's a blanket deal.
Who do they make a blanket deal with? It's not a cabal.
Well, radio pays like a mechanical license, and that's negotiated up front so that, you know, the record labels don't have to deal with 5 million radio stations coming to them and trying to negotiate everything separately.
Right, they track how many times they play a song, and they pay for every time they play a song. They pay money to the songwriters and the musicians and all that.
Right, or they pay a flat fee up front, and they pay it to SoundScan, and then that they have the rights.
But they never play a flat fee, though, because it's the more you play a song, every time a song is played, they make more money.
Well, that's a blanket license. So a radio station will typically, they'll purchase that from this mechanical license from BMI or ASCAP, and that lets the station play anything as long as, you know, that it's during that year. And then BMI decides how to split up the money. So they basically, the radio station says, look, we don't want to keep track of this. We will just pay you all this money, and then you go figure out what we play. Nope. We'll give you our playlists. So here's our playlist. Go figure out who gets the money.
Okay. So what's the difference in satellite and internet radio?
In satellite, they basically pay 8% of their revenues to folks like BMI. And again, say, you guys go figure out how much.
The fee is set in terrestrial radio as a dollar amount, not as a piece of revenue?
In satellite radio, it is.
No, it was terrestrial radio.
Yes, it is a fee. Yes, correct. So in terrestrial,
I'll give you $50. You decide what to do with it. In satellite, they say you get a percentage of how much money we make.
That's right. And the same is true for cable TV music services, those like music channels on your cable cable stations. They pay 15%, while online radio, and this is really just Pandora, since it's a public company, we can find this out. They pay over 50% of their revenues to these services. They pay it out.
Why is there so much higher?
Well, that's up for debate. And really, Richard Greenfield of BTIG Research is saying, look, Pandora, to try and woo customers away from terrestrial radio, that traditional radio that we all listen to in our car, at least we used to,
They don't play ads.
They don't play ads. Pandora basically plays one 15-second spot every now and again, maybe once an hour.
So the record labels say, hey, you're not running ads. You scare us. So we're going to make you pay a lot more money because we think your business model could destroy all these other types of radio.
Well, they basically have said, look, here's how much money we want. Here's our licensing fee. And because Pandora is not earning enough revenue, it is more than 50% of their revenue. And what Richard Greenfield of BTIG is saying is, hey, you know what? Run as many ads as they do on terrestrial radio.
No, I'm confused. aren't they paying a 50% of their revenue, whatever it is?
It just makes up 50% of their revenue.
So they're paying a flat fee, just like terrestrial radio.
Correct.
Whereas satellite radio and cable TV radio are paying a percentage of what they take in.
I believe so, yes. They're paying a flat... Yes, I would have to go back and double check that. But effectively, what Richard Greenfield is saying here is, if you earn more money, the percentage of your revenue that is being paid out in royalties would begin to drop.
Is anybody paying a cut of their revenue, a percentage cut? Is the deal you get X percent of what we make? Or is everybody paying a flat amount that turns out to be 8%, 15%, or 50%? I'm confused.
Okay, so satellite radio pays 8%.
No. Are they paying $100 or are they paying a percentage of their whatever they make? Are they paying a flat amount or are they paying a percentage of whatever they make?
Okay, so here's what it is.
I don't care what the percentage turns out to be.
I understand. Okay. It's 8%.
Listen.
It's what satellite pays in royalties is 8% of the revenues no matter what. Same thing with cable. They pay 15% no matter how much they make. They're paying 15% of the revenue.
And they're the only two that do that.
Right. Pandora, Spotify. Well, Spotify has its own deals, but let's talk about Pandora.
Terrestrial radio.
Terrestrial radio pays their blanket license fee.
So that's what Pandora plays as well, a blanket license fee.
No, they're paying per stream. And right now, they are paying based on how much revenue they're earning. They're not earning enough money, and therefore the amount they're paying out for all these streams of all this music, the amount they're paying out for that is over 50%. Now, if they earn more money...
But it's not that the rate is so onerous or not. That doesn't mean it's a lot of money. If they have no revenue, if they start today, it would be 100% of revenue or more than 100% because they don't have any income coming in. But that doesn't tell us whether the amount that they're being asked to pay is fair or not. The percentage of what they make is unimportant to me. What are they being asked to pay? Is it extraordinarily different than what everybody else pays?
They're saying, yes, it is. And that's why Tim Westergren...
But they can't base that based on how much revenue they make. That makes no sense. We're not part of their business. We don't care whether they live or die. What matters is, what are they paying compared to a similar company with a similar rate model, which is terrestrial radio?
Okay. Here we go. I just looked it up.
Thank goodness.
The 2012 rate...
Want to understand.
Okay. The 2012 rate for Pandora's free service is 0.0011 cents, so less than a penny, per performance, or 1.65 cents per listener per hour.
Or, so whichever is higher or lower?
I guess it all equals out. Assuming 15 songs per hour. Mm-hmm. So if it's 15 songs per hour, assuming you have a basically a penny and a half rate per hour at the maximum 40 hours of free listening per month, that amounts to just $7.92 per listener annually.
What is that compared to radio? Terrestrial radio. What do they pay?
Oh man, I just looked up this. I don't know.
Is it the same idea? I mean, the only way we have a fair argument is if we find out the terrestrial radio is paying, one-tenth of that or 100 times that. That's the only thing you can compare. You can't say, well, they're not making a lot of money and therefore this isn't fair. Well, tough. The fact of whether your business is failing or not is not important or reflect on whether the rate is fair. The only thing that reflects and it doesn't matter what your ad rate is. If you can get people to buy your subscription satellite radio, they don't have a lot of ads. All their ads are in-house ads to listen to this channel, listen to that show. They have very few ads like we're thinking of where, buy Tide detergent. So if their business model is working and they're able to keep their, costs down and make money, great. But that's not an issue of whether the royalty rate is fair or not. It only matters whether they're being disproportionately charged a lot more money than somebody else.
Yeah, and I don't know what the what the BMI license fee.
Why do people care? Because Pandora might disappear. Because they might have to add more ads onto their programming. What's the deal?
That's right. You just hit the nail on the head. If the royalty rates go up, Pandora may not be able to survive. And what Richard Greenfield of BTIG is saying is, why should the government have to subsidize Pandora? And I'll quote him.
Well,
here.
The government's not subsidizing. They're not paying money out. They're simply changing the rules. That wouldn't be subsidizing. That's just saying, why would the government get involved at all? Because every business needs regulation. If they're being unfairly penalized, then that might be appropriate for the Justice Department or someone else to step in. But that's not subsidizing.
You're absolutely right. I used the wrong word here.
I thought he did. I was going off on him.
Okay. He writes, Pandora chooses to not generate as much advertising revenue per streamed hour as it could to enhance
the
user.
So does satellite radio.
Right. To enhance the user experience and is capturing a share from terrestrial radio, satellite radio, and music downloading playlist sites such as iTunes. So Pandora is effectively asking the government to intervene and reduce its cost structure, helping it remain a viable business because it knows its business model only works while running limited advertising. Why should the U.S. government allow musicians to be harmed simply to help Pandora and its investors generate enhanced returns? It's actually kind of a valid argument.
What's valid? That the government shouldn't be involved at all?
Well, effectively saying...
Or that Pandora should have more ads? Or that they should be paying out more to artists? There's about three arguments in there.
Right. Well, you know, that's Richard Greenfield for you. But
Is he in the pocket of terrestrial radio? What's his agenda? Does he make stock recommendations? Maybe he has a sell... You know, I want to know when I hear about an analyst, I want to know who they are, what their history is. Are they, you know, somebody could say, oh, don't buy gold, and they might have a sell option on gold. So I want to know what their, do they have any skin in the game?
I don't know if they, I would imagine that they don't, because that would be, you know, obviously a conflict of interest.
No, people do it every day.
He does say, however, that royalty rates should increase on Pandora, and that they might need a better business model. And by the way, Sound Exchange says the same thing about Pandora, that royalty rates should increase and be...
They're talking about the amount paid out to artists because it's so infinitesimally small.
Right, correct.
And Pandora says, hey, we're not even making a profit yet very much.
And effectively, the industry is turning to them and saying, great, run more ads, just like, I don't know, radio. That's the long and short of it.
And we're going long, so let's wrap this puppy up. I hope people aren't too confused about Pandora.
Yeah, do you not understand anything about kilohertz and 24-bit sound and royalty rates?
I try.
I know, we thoroughly confused our listeners with our high frame rate. I know, we thoroughly confused our listeners with our high frame rate discussion in episode 160 with CJ Flynn.
Everybody hated that one.
Yeah, I mean, basically it was, wait, who's on first? And now we go back to put on our geek hats and confuse them all over again. So hopefully you were able to follow us, and you most definitely can follow us on Twitter, where our username is ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where our Facebook page is ShowbizSandbox. In fact, ShowbizSandbox.com is where you will find links to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode. It's also where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@ShowbizSandbox.com, or you can call us 888-567-7263. Again, that website is ShowbizSandbox.com. Pretty easy to remember. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, or, you know, maybe the new MySpace, or presently the old MySpace. Well, you know what I mean. Or, you know, you can go to their website, whoismgmt.com. Now, speaking of subscribing to things, you can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, any podcast aggregator or RSS reader, or, you know, just subscribe, rate, and review the show. We really appreciate it. Michael Giltz has a website. It is?
MichaelGiltz.com.
Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.